A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 359. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Dead of Night. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
We are looking at our annual Christmas ghost story this time. And in this case, it's the three remaining episodes of a BBC anthology series from 1972. There are three episodes, about 50 minutes each, and there were another four episodes which are missing, no longer available, so we can't look at those.
Yes, the strange nature of the BBC or British television archive at times. But these are ghost stories, obviously, for Christmas, but not in the traditional a ghost story for Christmas strand. And in fact, these have a much more modern setting for the time of 1972. And one thing in particular that we will note as we go along is some very interesting names involved in this production, both sides of the camera, front and behind. Some interesting people to talk about as we go along, Brian.
Yes, there is definitely some interesting stuff going on here. And yeah, interesting production. And I will note that there was a black and white anthology horror film from 1945 from Ealing Studios, which was also called Dead of Night. And that's different. So it's the 1972 one is what we're talking about.
And have you ever seen the 1945 film, Brian?
I have not. I don't know that one.
Oh, it is terrific. I'll just mention that. But yes, not to be confused with that. Here we are in 1972, and we start off with possibly the best known of the surviving episodes, an episode called The Exorcism, first broadcast on 5th of November 1972, written and directed by Don Taylor. And possibly the best remembered, the first one, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And it was the first episode in the original run of 7. It starred Anna Cropper, who we remember from Robin Redbreast, and Edward Petherbridge, who we saw in Casting the Runes, and also Clive Swift, who was in A Warning to the Curious in 1990. He was in Doctor Who, both in Revelation of the Daleks in the 80s, and also in Voyage of the Damned in the 2000s. And he's always a highlight to watch whenever he's there. So it's nice to have him involved.
Yes, great stuff with Clive Swift. And rounding off the cast in the only other speaking role, I think apart from a newsreader on television, is Sylvia Kay playing Clive Swift's wife. We haven't really seen her in any genre stuff, although she's a very recognisable face from British TV. I know she did appear in some Avengers episodes, apparently.
So this one has two middle-class couples getting ready to celebrate Christmas, and they are meeting in Edmund and Rachel's renovated country cottage. So you have one couple inviting in a second couple, and their conversation turns to how their comfortable lifestyles have moved them away from their sort of more socialist roots.
Yes, and that sort of sets the scene for what's to come in a way. It is all seems very lovely and middle class. The couple talking about how they found the cottage, how they renovated it. They also discuss their jobs. They're obviously their well-paid jobs in London. I think one of them works in public relations. One of them is a journalist. And as the evening progresses through this sort of pre-Christmas celebration meal they seem to be having, things start to go a bit awry. So strange events turn up. The lights all go out, the phones fail, a glass of wine suddenly tastes of blood. The meal itself becomes almost inedible to them and causes them some sort of almost food poisoning symptoms. And the stage is set for a terrible haunting from the past with a sort of clash between the past and the present, between the urban and the rural, and all leading to us to ask the question, who or what is being exorcised in the title of this piece? It's quite dramatic and striking stuff for a first episode, Brian.
Yes, it absolutely is. And I think the title of it is almost a misnomer. It's not what you would expect for something called The Exorcism, but it asks some interesting questions as it goes and has a lot going on in it. Based on the conversations, the things that these four people are experiencing, and the idea of the fact that they found this old cottage that has this history that no one really knows about, that they turned into something sort of new and quite fancy and slick for well-to-do London people to come out to in their off time.
Quite a clash.
Yes, absolutely. Don Taylor had been a staff writer at the BBC in the early 60s, producing many sort of social realist plays reflecting his political views.
Yeah, a very interesting chap who, as we say, had written or, you know, was sort of like well known for his grim and gritty social realist plays, the sort of thing that the 60s was quite interested in, both on the stage and on television and on film. And interestingly, Don Taylor apparently clashed with none other than Sidney Newman, that well-known name from British Invaders history, who, of course, came to the BBC with a more sort of remit to produce more popular entertainment. Although, interestingly, Don Taylor apparently was one of the names that Sidney Newman may have offered the production role for Doctor Who to before it passed to Verity Lambert.
How interesting. That would have been a very different show. There were almost, it seems like, factions at the BBC of people who wanted to do things with a bit with more political allegory, as you see here with Don Taylor. I think Malcolm Hulk, the writer, was very much in that group as well. And then you have people who are looking more towards other things that don't do that. So it's interesting to see that come up here with his interactions with Sidney Newman, who, as you say, had that big influence on British television with the Avengers and with Doctor Who particularly.
And, you know, it is particularly striking that we've got this episode which is about a clash between the old and the new as well, to some degree. Anyway, so Don Taylor had fallen out with Sidney Newman. He'd gone freelance away from the BBC. I think he was concentrating on stage plays. His most famous, well-known play from this period is The Roses of Eam from 1970, which still gets performed, I think, to this day. This is the one about the Derbyshire village that decided to isolate itself during the plague. Seems somewhat appropriate for modern day discussions at the moment. And interestingly enough, Brian, my wife, Susan, was in a stage production of The Roses of Eam playing the vicar's wife.
Oh my goodness, that's a connection I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that that continues to be performed, because it's very often that, you know, that a stage play will get a performance or a couple of performances and then sort of be put aside and not really get further performances later on.
Absolutely. And I did read one reference, which I couldn't find in any other sources, that The Exorcism may originally have been written for the stage, but it marked Don Taylor's return to the BBC in 1972. And of course, Sidney Newman had left the BBC in 1970. So that possible clash of personalities, I guess they avoided it. Anyway, he's back with possibly, you know, one of the most striking bits of television in 50 minutes from this era. We'll talk more about it in our next episode, but it is quite remarkable television, isn't it, Brian?
Yes, it definitely is. The second episode of the original run, and also the second one that we can look at on the DVD, is Return Flight, originally broadcast on November 12th, 1972. And it was written by Robert Holmes, who is a great figure in the history of Doctor Who, being a script editor in the mid-70s and having written lots of stories for Doctor Who from the 60s right into the 80s. And this was directed by Rodney Bennett, who also directed for Doctor Who, The Ark in Space, The Santarin Experiment, and The Mask of Mandragora. So some strong 1970s Tom Baker stories there. Return Flight starred Peter Barkworth, who was in Doctor Who and The Ice Warriors, Bernard Brown, who was in that adaptation of Random Quest for Out of the Unknown in 1969, unfortunately missing, that I would have loved to have seen that.
Indeed, yes, sounds fascinating.
Ardo Morris was in it as well, who was Quarmby in The Guardians.
And if I remember rightly, Brian, from The Guardians, Quarmby was a sort of generic name for the Resistance. And so there were several characters who had that name, because Peter Barkworth is listed as playing a version of Quarmby in The Guardians as well. And just another little link, Edward Petherbridge from The Exorcism was also in The Guardians as well.
Yes, very nice. Interesting show that one was too.
It was indeed. So Return Flight has Peter Barkworth, as you say, playing a commercial airline pilot. He seems rather bored and dissatisfied with his job. He's also dealing with the loss of his wife, who passed away recently. And he's got this sort of commercial route where he flies backwards and forwards from Germany, and he's just generally a little bit dissatisfied, particularly when he compares himself to older pilots, many of whom of course served in the RAF during the war, something that he was just too young to do himself. So he's a slightly disaffected and disappointed sort of chap in the central role.
Yes, that's right. He very much seems to be towards the end of his career and looking back on his career as something that was not as eventful or as interesting as he wanted it to be, largely because he was just a little bit too young to have flown during the war. And we see this routine flight that he's on is interrupted by a near miss from another plane. But no one else saw that plane except for him. And it was initially not identified on radar either. So there's this question, what did he see?
Indeed. And then there's some strange voices he's hearing on the radio. There's a story from the past involving the war. So there's some interesting stuff going on for this character at the center of it all, whether he's been haunted by something. And again, we're sort of heading towards a tricky and difficult climax for this episode.
Yes, absolutely. And interesting and nice to have Robert Holmes show up here, who wrote for Doctor Who from 1968 through 86 on and off. And it was 74 to 77 that he was script editor. And he had a big influence on Doctor Who for sure. When he took over as script editor and Philip Hinchcliffe took over as producer in 74, they brought a style that was unlike what had been seen before, and in many ways unlike what was seen later than that, with more spooky things being brought in and a different style of production. And he had some interesting influence in his later stuff into the 80s as well. So very interesting figure in the history of Doctor Who, and always nice to see him turn up as a writer in other things, as we see here.
And I guess we've said this before, Brian, for a show as huge as Doctor Who on the British televisual landscape, I suppose it's not surprising that the creators involved, we often see them working on other shows as well. And I like the idea of these well-known Doctor Who writers, which monsters they created. So am I right that Robert Holmes creates the Autons and the Sontarans?
Yes, and the rights for both of those, I believe, rest with his estate. as happened with things that were created for Doctor Who in the classic series that were not initially intended to be ongoing features. So the Autons and the Santarans were both planned as things just for those introductory stories, so he retained the rights to them. He also wrote The Nightmare Man, which we covered quite some time ago, and he wrote for Blake 7 as well, and a couple of interesting episodes there too.
And possibly one of the, certainly in the top tier of Doctor Who serials from the classic era, The Caves of Androzani. That's a Robert Holmes as well, I think, isn't it, Brian?
Yes, it is. That's one of the later ones he did. The finale for the Fifth Doctor.
Fantastic stuff. So if we turn to our production notes, Dead of Night was created for the BBC by producer, here's another name, Innes Lloyd, who again had been a producer on Doctor Who from 1966 to 1968 and saw the show through an incredibly difficult transition period from the First Doctor to the Second Doctor, one of the sort of like key moments in Doctor Who television history, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. He and the script editor, Jerry Davis, are credited with coming up with the idea of regeneration or the concept. It was not called regeneration then. That term was introduced later. But the idea of recasting the Doctor by having this sort of renewal, this strange change that would be seen on screen, and having the change also be something that affects the Doctor's personality, and he would be a new Doctor. That seems sort of obvious for Doctor Who now, but it was a really big and unusual idea to throw into things at the time.
Fascinating stuff that he may have come up with it, as you say, with Jerry Davis.
Yeah. We also talked about him recently for his work on An Englishman's Castle.
Right. Yes, we did, didn't we? That's right. So the late 1960s and early 70s seem to have been a very popular time for anthology series on British television, particularly horror anthology series. We could mention Out of the Unknown. We've already talked about the success of ITV's Mystery and Imagination series that ran from 1966 to 1970. The BBC themselves had done a show called Late Night Horror in 1968. And I think there's only one episode of that survives, has recently been returned to the archive, Brian. But unfortunately, that's not one that's got a DVD release that we can see. But Innes Lloyd, obviously inspired by the popularity of anthology series, had wanted to create some supernatural tales, but with a contemporary setting and feel to them. And this is something I think he talked about, Brian, this sort of contemporary idea for the ghost story.
Yes, and that was a fairly new thing to want to do on television at that point in 72. In an interview, he said, "There is nothing at all gothic about the series. No characters in sheets, no funny noises late at night." And that was sort of something he wanted to do with this, was have something much more contemporary with ghost stories. And he did borrow the title from that Ealing anthology horror film from 1945.
Yes, he did. And that prompted a letter, I gather.
Yes, that prompted a sort of annoyed letter to the Radio Times from Ealing producer Sir Michael Balkan. At the time, the Radio Times was a BBC publication, so this was quite a direct way, a direct and public way for this producer to be expressing his annoyance at this.
Yes, it does seem slightly strange. We've got these two classic British anthology horrors, both called Dead of Night, but there you go. One on the big screen, one on television. Innes Lloyd wanted, as we say, the best contemporary television writers as well. So, of course, Don Taylor, Robert Holmes, John Bowen we'll be talking about next time, other people like Hugh Whitemore. And interestingly, another great name for us, Brian, something that we discovered while researching this, Nigel Neal was commissioned to write an episode of the series, an episode that was initially titled, or going to be called, Breakthrough. And, of course, regular listeners will know, that becomes the Stone Tape. And then at some point during the pre-production, I think possibly because Nigel Neal's script was for a 90-minute episode rather than the 50-minute slot that Dead of Night had, it was decided to put the Stone Tape out by itself and not as part of the Dead of Night anthology. So it goes out on Christmas Day 1972, just over a week after the very last episode of Dead of Night had dropped, but interestingly shared, I think, pretty much the same production team, including Innes Lloyd and the script editor.
Yes, I guess they wanted to give it that 90-minute slot, and once they were doing that at that time, that made it a separate play rather than being part of this anthology. And that, of course, was a very good story itself, and I think it was a good choice that they gave it that 90-minute slot.
Gave it some room to breathe, and I don't think I knew that when we did the Stone Tape previously on British Invaders, which is a few years ago, but another great classic of British television.
Yes. Dead of Night was script edited by Louis Marks, who had written for Danger Man and also for Doomwatch, which we've covered, and of course for Doctor Who. And he would go on to be the Play for Today producer in the 1970s. So that's a very big position to take on Play for Today.
Yes, a huge, another huge strand on British television.
The spooky music for this series, and it was definitely a real part of things, was composed by Herbert Chappell and played over some scary images of someone running through the woods with a sort of red image of the titles for the opening titles. And that was pretty effective in addition to the incidental music in here.
Yes, just look at the opening titles on YouTube of Dead of Night and it will set you in the mood.
The full run of 7 episodes for Dead of Night was broadcast from November 5th to December 17th. Sort of in the lead up to the Christmas season, it was definitely that feel, in 1972.
And the only repeat I can find was, of course, that the exorcism, the possibly the most famous episode from the 7, was later repeated by the BBC, but that was in December 2007, quite some time later. But of course, it was also adapted by Don Taylor for the stage, although he may have already intended it to start there, and as a radio play for Radio 4 in 1992. And there's an interesting story, kind of a sort of sad, tragic story, about a 1975 London theatre production of The Exorcism with a cast that included Honor Blackman, Brian Blessed, and Mary Ure. Mary Ure, probably best known for playing the female lead in Where Eagles Dare, opposite Richard Burton. But sadly, that production was marked by tragedy because apparently after a reportedly bad opening night, Mary Ure was later found dead of an overdose. So I'm guessing, I'm not sure what happened to the rest of that production. It can be quite difficult to find details of theatre productions from the past, can't it, Brian?
Yeah, oh, that really is sad. I wonder if they did continue or relaunch that run with the remaining cast, or indeed if that play has been performed since then. Certainly, Honor Blackman and Brian Blessed on stage in this would have been something, I could imagine.
Yes, absolutely. Somebody will probably point me at the equivalent of IMDb for theatre productions, and then we'll have a look.
Yes, that would be nice. Now, we mentioned that there were 7 episodes of this, and we only have 3 of them to look at. 4 of them were wiped and are no longer in the BBC archive, as many things in that era from the BBC and ITV and all sorts of places around the world were not keeping things they were considered not needed at that point. So it is 3 of those original 7 that we can look at now.
And how many times have we talked about the vagaries of television companies and what they decided to archive and what they decided to tape over? Quite a few times it's come up, Brian.
Yes, it is extremely common that things from the past are no longer available because of that. And whenever we find out about an old TV production that might be interesting to us, the very first question is, does it still exist? And very often the answer is no.
Yeah. So let's talk about what does exist, the availability. In Region 2, I've got the rather lovely BFI DVD release that came out in 2013. Obviously includes the three surviving episodes. You will find PDF scripts of the other four episodes and some production stills from those episodes. Not enough that you could do any form of telesnap reconstruction, but they are there. And also, because it's the BFI, we get a rather nice booklet with lots of articles, reviews of the three episodes, an in-depth sort of look at the life and work of people like Innes Lloyd, Don Taylor, Louis Marx, Robert Holmes, John Bowen. So quite a nice package for £15. Sadly, doesn't seem to be on the BFI's own streaming service, which seems to mainly be, as the name would suggest, films rather than television. But the DVD release still available and a nice little package. Across the pond in Region 1.
In Region 1, there is no release. So this is one that you would want to import and play the Region 2 discs. And as you say, these BFI releases tend to be very nice packages. They tend to do quite a nice job with that.
And they also include all sorts of technical details, including the restoration and so on, which is stuff that's beyond me, but I guess is part of the fascinating package that they put together.
Yes, having that information available is nice, for sure. So next time, we will talk about the third surviving episode, and we will touch on some of the stories from the missing episodes as well, and maybe put this in context with some of the other shows from this period that we've looked at.
Plenty still to talk about. Plus, of course, we're going to give you our recommendations about this DVD set from the BFI when we come back.
We will. And until then, you can find all of our episodes at BritishInvaders.com. Or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find our group there and join in our discussions.
Yes, please do. Tell us what Christmas ghost story you'll be watching on television this year. And we are also to be found at VogNetwork.com, which is the Voice of Geeks Network, where we are part of the team there. Pop along and say hello. Tell them Brian and Eamon sent you along.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Until next time, Eamon in England also signing off.